headlines. Afghanistan is facing an urgent need for medical supplies to provide treatment for thousands of injuries following a recent tragic earthquake. Fresh violence by Israeli occupation forces takes the life of one more Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. And Ukrainian forces preparing for a full withdrawal from the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk, bringing Russia closer to capturing Luhansk. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. In Afghanistan, five more people have died in an aftershock in almost the same area of major quake in the east on Wednesday. This adds to over 1,000 people killed on the day the natural disaster happened. There has been no immediate word on the extent of the new damage and injuries. The country's disaster ministry says over 2,000 were injured on Wednesday. It also says around 10,000 houses were partially or completely destroyed. Authorities have ended a search for survivors. The 6.1 magnitude quake was the strongest hit Afghanistan in over two decades. Officials say the country lacks the necessities to treat the injured people and provide survivors with food, water, and shelter. A number of countries have also offered emergency aid. Three humanitarian aid flights from Iran have landed in Afghanistan.
After a nine-hour-long trip from the Afghan capital Kabul, we have arrived in Gayan district in southeastern Paktika province. The residents have to stay outdoors in the cold weather, without access to basic needs.
All houses here have been ruined as a result of the earthquake. In some areas, all members of a single family have been killed. Currently, women, children, and elders are in a very bad situation and need urgent help.
Next day, as the sun rises, we visit more quake-ravaged houses. People still continue the search and rescue operation. It seems like every home here has had some killed or injured.
This is Naim Khan's house, which is destroyed after Wednesday's powerful earthquake here in Gayan district in Paktika province. Mr. Naim Khan says that he has lost two of his relatives and five others are injured. We ask him about this earthquake and about the situation here.
At around 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, the earthquake struck here. Two of my family members were killed and five others injured. We also lost our livestock. Our livelihoods and food supplies are buried under rubble. There's nowhere to go. We need help, and our houses should be rebuilt.
Four of the Taliban ministers and aid agencies arrived in the collapsed villages to address the needs of desperate people. They're providing food items, blankets, tents, medicines, and other basic necessities. But it's clear more help is needed.
The leadership has ordered all related governmental institutions to reach the quake-stricken areas and take necessary measures. In addition, the Prime Minister is going to pay money to families of the victims.
Humanitarian aid agencies have arrived here to carry out the required programs. Based on our assessment, more than 8,000 houses have so far been confirmed destroyed here in Gayan. These affected people need help immediately.
The earthquake comes as Afghanistan is facing drought, famine, and hunger, triggered by cuts in global aid and the U.S. sanctions. The Taliban officials have called on the U.S. to release Afghan frozen assets. Rahmatullah Baghban, Paktika province of Afghanistan.
A Palestinian teenager has succumbed to injuries that he sustained by Israeli gunfire in the occupied West Bank on Friday. Israeli forces hit 16-year-old Mohammed Hamad during a raid in the town of Silwad. He is the second Palestinian to fall victim to Israeli violence in a week. The other one was killed near the Kalkia refugee camp. Israeli forces had accused him of trying to cross the separation barrier. The situation remains volatile across the occupied territories, with Israeli forces and settlers keeping up their acts of violence against Palestinians. Troops often resort to live rounds, citing different pretexts against Palestinians protesting against raids or illegal demolitions of their homes. Tel Aviv has also intensified detaining Palestinians, including children, who are being held without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. An investigation by the UN Human Rights Office has concluded that veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists covering an Israeli raid in Jenin were targeted by, quote, seemingly well-aimed bullets. This report has more.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East Al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Syrian army has launched a ground military operation against the Daesh terror group in the northern province of Raqqa. The operation kicked off on Thursday, taking place in an area in the southeast of Raqqa province. It follows increased activity by remnants of Daesh terrorists in that area in recent weeks. That, according to Russia's Sputnik news agency, citing local sources, it says government troops backed by Syrian and Russian warplanes have killed a number of terrorists without specifying. Just earlier this week, Daesh claimed a bus attack in the same Raqqa area killed 13 people. Syria has a long complained that Daesh and other terror groups it is fighting are backed by Western states. To discuss that further, we're joined by Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian, joining us live from London, and also Fra Hughes, author and journalist from Belfast. Let's begin with Marcus Papadopoulos. Sir, Syria has already had a lot on its plate, from illegal U.S. military presence to the Israeli attacks on its sovereignty, and Turkey's plans, of course, for an incursion. And now this sudden uptick in Daesh offensives. How do you evaluate Syria's response to this latest challenge?
Well, whilst most of Syrian soil has been liberated by the Syrian Arab Army, which is the defender of multi-confessional Syria, whereby Muslim and Christian soldiers stand side by side and fight side by side to defend their fatherland from the clutches of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, nonetheless, parts of Syria remain illegally occupied by foreign forces. Thus, in the northeast of Syria, parts there are illegally occupied by the American army, and parts of in the northwest of Syria are illegally occupied by the Turkish army, which works in coordination with Al-Qaeda. And let us be very clear about something. Those parts of Syria which are illegally occupied are illegally occupied by two NATO members, which completely refutes the argument of NATO's leaders that the military bloc is a defensive and peaceful one. Now, under international law, the Syrian Arab Army, which is the only legitimate military force in Syria, has every right to conduct an offensive to liberate what remains in Syria occupied by foreign forces. Syria is a member of the United Nations. Syria's borders are recognized by the United Nations. The sanctity of internationally recognized borders has, however, been completely violated by the illegal occupation of parts of northern Syria by two NATO members, America and Turkey. So again, I can only emphasize that the Syrian Arab Army is within its full rights to conduct an offensive to liberate Raqqa. And indeed, if the day comes when the Syrian Arab Army launches an offensive to liberate parts of northeastern Syria, which are occupied illegally, the Syrian Arab Army would also be fully entitled to do so under international law.
So, Mr. Papadopoulos, you pointed to a few very interesting issues right there. Let's bring in Fra Hughes. Mr. Hughes, Syria is launching a fresh offensive to eliminate pockets of Daesh that have been staging attacks on military and civilian targets in parts of the country. How serious do you see the risk of Daesh terrorists making a comeback in Syria?
Well, it could be argued the fact that they have become more active is proof that either their numbers have increased, they have been emboldened by the aid, succor, and support that they gained from Turkey. It could be a prelude to further Turkish incursion and illegal military occupation of further parts of Syria. They could very much be used as a spearhead to probe, to attack, and to destabilize the whole northeastern region of Syria. The Syrian government does have a moral duty to its troops and its civilians to protect the infrastructure that's being used, the highways and the byways by which people travel, by which commerce travels.
Okay, Mr. Hughes, there are reports of U.S. forces relocating Daesh elements from Iraq and jails inside Syria to near their bases. American forces are said to be providing intensive military training to Daesh operatives. How do you read into that? What are the U.S. plans for Syria, in your opinion?
Important thing for the American administration in Syria at the moment, apart from the continued destabilization of the country, continuing the war, is to solidify its positions, because it wants the oil and it wants the wheat. Again, the conflict in Ukraine, which is affecting oil prices, oil supply, wheat prices and wheat supply, has a mirror image in Syria. While Syrians are starving, their natural resources are being stolen by America. I do agree that it's in American interests to draw Russia further into the conflict in Syria, but I believe it will only be the Russian Air Force and not necessarily Russian troops who will be drawn further into the and onto the battlefield.
Thank you. Farahi is author and journalist out of Belfast, and Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. Moving on, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has sat down for talks with the EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell in Tehran. They have discussed relations between Iran and the European Union, as well as international developments. Also on the agenda is the Vienna talks held in the past year over the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. The Vienna talks have been focusing on the removal of sanctions, which the U.S. reinstated, that is, on Iran after pulling out of the deal in 2018. Iran says the negotiations are now awaiting a political decision by the U.S., which has been participating indirectly. Iran also says that all sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner in order for the revival of the agreement to be reached. And we're moving on to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Officials in Kiev say that they have ordered troops to withdraw from Severodonetsk, a key battleground city in the eastern Donbass region. The officials say that they aim to avoid more casualties and allow forces to regroup as very little are left to defend the city. The withdrawal marks the biggest retreat by Ukraine since the loss of the southern port city of Mariupol last month. The pullout is also seen as a significant Russian victory over Ukraine's eastern commercial hub. The war, which began 4 months ago, is now focused on the eastern Donbass region. With the fall of Severodonetsk and its adjoining city, Lysychansk, it is likely to become a new battlefield in the east. A recent Russian advances appear to bring it closer to taking full control of Luhansk province, and that is a key province in Donbass region. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further, because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, "Oh, it's not so bad." When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane.
I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa? Or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with this?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana. Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I said, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. You happy? Is anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, if my security is gone into administration, we'll be taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm. All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Ozone.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belen Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belen and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belen's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the Gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering three continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and 2 euros apiece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continued to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends 130 billion euros a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anané has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are working order, but some material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use our resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
you were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to get to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. What about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler? They'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio Station. You guys are listening to the show For a Better Life. With you today is your brother and current servant, Habib. So today we're going to be starting off with a new topic, and that is pretty much love for making our lives better. And today I want to talk about precisely love between the parent and between the child, the importance of showing the love from the parent to the child, and how we can help our children to have better life in their future, and how our connection, our lives with our children could be better, inshallah ta'ala. When we reach adulthood and after the marriage process, which by itself is a topic that we should talk about, and we become desiring to have children. This is normal. Some people want to have children. Some may do not want to have children for some reasons. For example, some of them might see the cost of having children very hard, or as something that denies them from having children. Some people do not want to take the responsibility of parenthood. Some people just don't like children at all and just, you know, want to have their partner to be with them. Of course, in the Islamic teachings, we have that it's recommended that it's been emphasized that we must have that we have children and we increase our children. One of the things that the Prophet ﷺ states, marry and have children, for on the day of judgment, I will be proud or will bloat about the children that you have, and various sayings that state, ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for children and have children so that the earth may be filled with people who state La ilaha illallah. Now, when having children, the process of raising them becomes very important and vital. Parents start to think, how do we raise our children in the correct manner? How do we have a better life with our children? How can we make their lives better? When returning to the sayings of Ahlul Bayt alayhum salam and their teachings, we understand one thing, we can find one thing, we can feel one thing, and that is the importance of making a love connection between our children, making a love connection between the father, mother, and the child. And for example, we have the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam that states that whoever has a child will become childish. And that is because the parent must become like a child, must play with the child, must go to the level of the child to gain that trust and connection, that relationship with the child. Now, brothers and sisters, we'll be taking a short break. Please stay tuned and we'll see you after the break.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Assalamu alaikum. Greetings, brothers and sisters. Thank you guys for joining us again. The Prophet ﷺ states, whoever kisses his child, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will write down a deed or a good deed for him. And whoever makes them happy, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make them happy on the day of judgment. And whoever teaches them Quran, this is the continuation of the saying, whoever teaches them Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give them dresses of diamonds and garnets on the day of judgment. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will brighten their faces in the hereafter. So we see this emphasis from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi and Ahlul Bayt to love our children, to respect our children. A man came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He asked him, who do I do good to? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told him, your parents. He said that my parents passed away. He said, do good to your children. So we have this emphasis that we should do good to our children. We should respect them. We should show them love. And that creates that love connection between the father, mother, and the child. And this love connection between the two opens the doors for many things. One of the most important things is that when you raise your child, that love connection is available. I have a friend who does not do any sin. Why? Out of respect for his father. He does not have that strong religious beliefs or that strong religious creed. Yet, he does not do anything wrong that may, you know, harm the picture or image of his father. Out of respect for his father. This slowly starts to change into a more religious thing out of time. But the important thing was that he did not go into these sins. He did not go into these bad actions in the first place. Why? Out of love of his parents, out of love of his father. So when we have that connection with the child, raising the child will become easier. We have this saying from Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, when asked about hitting children or beating children. Imam Kadhim alayhi salam rebuked this action and stated that no, do not hit your child, but rather abandon them. When abandoning them, do not take long in returning to them. That will be much better for their raising or upbringing. And that really just opens the eyes of the importance of that love connection. See, when you have this connection with your child and you say that I am not happy with you, I'm angry with you, or I'm not going to talk to you, or you do not talk to them at all. This, and there's that love that he has, or that she has, and she wants to continue this connection. She wants this connection to grow. You are the most important thing for them. You're the thing that revolves around their universe. And when you do not talk to them, that really hurts more. That really raises more. That trains more than beating the child. Therefore, this first connection, this love connection between the child and the parents is very vital. It's very important. It's something that also helps them in the future. And we have the saying in summary that may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have mercy on those who help their children and doing good to them. The Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked, how do we help them in doing good for us? He replied, by respecting them while they're young, by forgiving them. And that really just gives these are just detailed concepts of that general concept of love and respect, that connection that you have with that child.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The more love you show to your child, the more that he will respect you when you grow up. So that's going to aid you as well. So this is just one concept available, that love relationship between the parents and the child. And now this is also something important. I always think about this when I look at my child personally. And that is that when he grows up, when she grows up, when I look at my children, I see that if I do not give them love, if I do not give them respect, who's going to give them love and respect? Who are they going to expect to love them and respect them? And that's going to be that's something also very dangerous on the other hand, that, for example, someone can use this love and use this respect for no good, to deceive them, to use them, to trick them. If they have this emptiness in love, or they need this love and they find it somewhere else, they're going to go somewhere else and take it. So that is very important, that the parents always love their children, they kiss their children, they show that empathy, that love, and even like in hugging and kissing, telling them that you love them, showing that love. You know, we sometimes have problem in showing this love. In summary, it's like how the Prophet ﷺ said, when a man came to him and said that I have never kissed my children, and he left, the Prophet ﷺ said, this man, if he remains in this status, he is one of the people of hellfire. For raising your children better, for helping you raise your children better, for them to respect you in the future, for them to not fall into the traps of, let's call them, the human devils, show that love connection with your children, whether it be it by hugging, by kissing, by telling them that you love them, by keeping your promises and making this relationship bigger and stronger and tighter to help you guys in the future. Thank you guys for joining us on IRB English Radio Station for a better life. From now until another show, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows.
tear on every eyelash. He knows every thought I have and every word I share. He knows, Allah knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.